Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Lauren Worsham. We also review It's Only a Play, Inner Voices 2014 at TBG Theater, and It Has to Be You at the Abington Theater Company. That plus more. Please stay tuned.
We lived right side left,
or even left side right,
back side front,
or front side back,
would shed a better light. Black might just be white. Day might just be night. If we knew the truth about each other,
hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 19th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Peter Frelicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hiya.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael. With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Lauren Worsham is with us. Lauren's a Tony-nominated actress from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, and also has a concert, the New York Philharmonic concert of Showboat coming up in the beginning of November. Lauren, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us.
Thank you for calling me and waking me up.
It's what we do. So, how has the last year of your life been? Has it been upside down?
It really has. You know, it's been something I've been working towards for a really long time. And when it finally happened, you know, it really does turn your life upside down, and you don't know what to expect. So it's been quite a journey, quite a trip, a wonderful trip.
How long were you involved with Gentleman's Guide?
I did a workshop, I guess, February of, gosh, I'm terrible with years. It's 2014 now, so I think maybe 2012, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think. And they were asking me to do the out of towns, but I was unable because I was doing Turn of the Screw with New York City Opera, the way it's a great New York City Opera, and another opera, Dog Days, out at Montclair Peak Performances, that, you know, opera schedule things much farther in advance than a musical theater does. So I was unable to do the out of town. But when they came back, they asked me to come back in and audition, and I booked it.
Well, that's awesome. And aside from doing your 8 a week in Gentleman's Guide, you also are very active with Sky Pony, aren't you?
Yes, that's my rock band with my husband. we've been playing together now for, I think, gosh, maybe 4 years. You know, it's kind of like a glam indie rock band. Heidi Wilson from Wall Street Journal, who's a classical music critic, actually came to see one of our shows and said that we were a classic girl group on crack. Which I take as a compliment.
That, you know, so there's the inevitable comparisons to Lena Hall. Are you and Lena buds?
Yeah, we actually played a gig together. It was back-to-back Sky Pony and the Deafening gig on October, I'm terrible with dates, I think it was about 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she came after her show, I came after my show, we stayed all late, we partied, and we went back to playing a regular Broadway gig.
Lauren, was that Turn of the Screw, was that the one with Lauren Flanagan?
No. It was directed by Sam Buntrock, who did Revival of Sunday in the Park, mm-hmm, a few years ago.
Yes.
And they were, let's see, who was in it, the name? Dominic Armstrong played the creepy dead guy.
creepy dead guy.
Creepy dead guy. I'm totally terrible with this early in the morning with remembering names, but it was was a great production. He kind of tried to recreate horror movies of the 1980s, so he said of the 1980s, and which meant I got to wear a lot of baggy clothing. I was playing a child, so it was very comfortable. I remember one thing they did is they had me emerge, you know, in the last one of the last scenes, the girl jumps into the lake where she's been seeing the dead people to try to go get her doll to, like, join the dead last nanny. And they had me come out on stage sopping wet. So I had to go off stage, sit in a bucket, and they pour water all over me. And then I had to walk back out on stage. And I was really enjoying it, but then I got a note saying, please don't turn around so fast. Your hair is so wet, it's whipping water into the orchestra. And I was getting, you know, these priceless, you know, musical instruments wet, and the musicians were clearly not happy with that. But I really enjoyed that.
Well, that sounds great.
So you seem to be spanning between multiple musical genres, between your operatic all the way to your musical theater, and now your Sky Pony. What was your background in music growing up? Where did you grow up, and how did you get introduced to music?
I grew up in Austin, Texas, which is called the live musical capital of the world. Mm-hmm. Music, not musical, but I grew up there doing music theater, but I also, one of the first types of music I sang was the blues, because that was Texas blues. It was very popular in Texas, you know, people like Tony Price, Marsh Ball. I had a great voice teacher who was just a local blues teacher, and that's how I started singing. And then once I got into high school, got in choir, discovered I could sing high. And then I started doing kind of studying with an opera teacher and dabbling in classical music. And my freshman year of college, I was cast in Candide. And I didn't realize I could sing that high, pretty high. But I'd say I really started on the opera, you know, classical music track after I was cast again in Candide after college with New York City Opera once again, the Hal Prince revival. That was in, 2000, I don't know, maybe 7, 8.
That was Daniel Reichardt, right?
Exactly, yes. And Richard Kind and Judy Blazer. It was a blast. And New York City Opera set me up with a voice teacher who is still my voice teacher to this day. And she has helped me take great leaps with my classical voice. And it's kind of helped across the board, you know, good singing technique helps in any genre and any style that you choose. So she's been amazingly helpful.
What's her name?
Virginia Grasso.
Oh, okay, great.
She's lovely.
So then, so you're wrapping up, as we sent earlier on the 26th of October, your Gentleman's Guide run, just about a year on Broadway. And then you're
a year to the date, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
That worked out really well.
I was just about to say, yeah.
And now you're going into the Philharmonic's production of Showboat, so, and playing Magnolia. So
yeah.
How did you get involved with that?
Well, I've worked with Ted Sperling before with some collegiate chorale concerts and other things. And I got a call from my agent that said, you know, Ted's conducting and directing Showboat with the New York Phil, and they'd like you to sing Magnolia. And I said, yes, absolutely.
Quite, how much of the other cast did you know when you said yes? Because it's quite star-studded.
I knew none of the other cast. I just knew it was Showboat with the New York Philharmonic. How could I say no?
Wow.
But, you know, I have since learned about the amazing cast. I'm really, really most excited about Fred Willard. He's playing Captain Andy, and I just think he's so hilarious. So just, you know, of course, he probably is just a normal human being who's not going to be cracking jokes all the time, but in my head and in my dreams, he is. I'm also excited for Julian Ovenden, of course, because I'm a big Downton Abbey fan, and Vanessa Williams, of course. You know, she's a star. So I'm very excited.
One of the most recent announcements was Norm Lewis.
Yes, so absolutely. Oh, that voice.
Singing Old Man River, that's going to be worth the price of admission, isn't it?
No kidding. Oh, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited. It's I start rehearsal at 10 a.m. the day after my last show with Gentleman's Guide, so rest for the weary. Literally, straight into it.
I was just going to ask you if you've already been in rehearsal. I mean, certainly you know much of the Magnolia music already, but
yeah, in classical music, you know, you show up.
Yeah.
Having learned everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of nice. Then you can just concentrate on how you're rehearsing and instead of you know, learning everything the first week.
Well, it's really great that you're going to get to do that part, Lauren, because I you know, obviously full productions are not that common anymore, and this is not a full production in the sense of being fully staged, but it sounds like they're going to do the bulk of the score.
They are. It's very exciting, especially since, you know, the last revival was in 1994, which is 10 years ago. And in Broadway standards, you know, I feel like these days they revive things so often. It seems like it's 20 years. Oh my gosh. My husband just told me it's early.
I was going to say that doesn't sound right. 10 years.
My math is a little fuzzy this early. He just whispered to me 20. So in Broadway standards, that's a really long time. So it seems like, you know, it should be due.
Do you have siblings that were also involved in the arts, or was this a...
My brother is a singer-songwriter. He lives in L.A. His name is Parker Ainsworth. He took his middle name as his last name for his performance name. But yeah, he's a wonderful singer-songwriter. You know, he's not a theater performer, but he is a great performer on stage. You know, he tells stories and sings songs, and he's kind of a wandering bard. He's traveled to India and Iceland and the Antarctic and the Arctic, and, you know, he's pretty cool guy.
So you're wrapping up, gentlemen, and you're going to be doing Showboat. What's anything else on the horizon that you can tell us about?
Yeah. After that, I have 3 weeks off, and I'm going to be enjoying Thanksgiving with my family, which seems like a huge luxury after the busyness of the past year. And then I'm doing, the next big concert I'm doing is Not the Messiah with the Collegiate Chorale. And it's the concert version of an adaptation of The Life of Brian from Monty Python. And Eric Idle from Monty Python will be in the group along with Mark Kudish and, my brain. Victoria Clark. It's going to be a ton of fun, just in time for the holidays. It's really funny. It's two concerts, the 15th and 16th of December. And then in early January, I'm doing a new opera as part of the Prototype Festival, which is a new opera, a new works festival, kind of taking the place of New York City Opera's Vox, which was a new works program. And I'm doing a piece called Winter's Child by Ellen Reed, who's a wonderful composer outside of from L.A. I'm really excited about that. And then in 2015, I'm doing two productions of the same piece that I did back in 2012, I believe, called Dog Days by David Little and Royce Maverick. We'll be doing it in Fort Worth Opera and then L.A. Opera. There'll be premieres in both of those companies, you know, the West Coast premiere and I guess the Southern premiere. And David's an amazing composer. He's one of the new crop of artists to be commissioned by the Met. So he's really a composer to look out for. He does this wonderful thing with classical music where he infuses it with hummable melodies in the way that pop music, you know, has hummable melodies, and honestly in the way that old operas have hummable melodies, but also kind of a modern sensibility. It's kind of like there's electric guitars and drums. So it's really quite fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to that. So I'm kind of booked through June 2015.
Oh, that's good. That's awesome.
I think our listeners who are not necessarily that familiar with opera or classical music maybe don't realize how far in advance these things tend to be booked. It just doesn't happen in the theater.
I've had this gig on the books for about 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, they do it really far in advance in opera. I don't know what happens, you know, when Lauren Flanagan or somebody just, you know, decides they don't want to, you know. I guess, do they tell them a year in advance, or do they tell them, I don't know what their call-out period is, but they do it very far in advance.
Standbys find out 4 months in advance.
Right.
we we can't possibly make a change. We only have 2 years left. So
right, exactly. I know, it's pretty.
We talk about.
I guess operas take so long to put together. You know, they're such cheap. But then again, so is musical theater. I don't know.
Well, also, it's partly because that there are the relatively few names in the opera business, and they build things around them. But then they have to compete with other opera companies. So
that
that's one reason why.
I mean, we talked about Lady Day and how fast that Audra and the production team pulled that together when the Yankee show closed, the Yogi Berra show. I forget what the name of it was.
So, oh yeah,
Bronx Bombers.
Yeah. So I mean, those sort of things do happen fast, and we never know. But tell me about your experience at Yale. And studying there, and what happened with your path to Broadway after Yale?
Huh. Well, I kind of went to Yale out of a fluke. I decided I wanted to go when I was in middle school. I know, it sounds funny, but...
I kind of went to Yale on a fluke. Okay.
Well, I thought that I got confused in my middle school brain with the drama graduate program and the undergraduate drama program, because they're very well known for the drama school, but they're not necessarily incredibly well known for their undergraduate program. Now it's different.
Sure.
They've kind of built up this new Yale Musical Theater Initiative, blah, blah, blah. But that's how I decided I want to go there. And then after I found out that, oh, it's the drama school, not, you know, the undergrad, I still wanted to go there. And I applied their early decision. It's the only place I applied. And, I got in, thank God. And, I decided when I went there, I was like, oh, I'm going to not do theater and music. I'm going to do like something serious, you know? And then, you know, the first thing I did was audition for Candide and got into Candide and, you know, did all these, I mean, every year I did, you know, two or three theater productions in addition to singing in an a cappella group. But I majored in Spanish literature, which I clearly have made great use of. But then after Yale, you know, it's kind of I say there's kind of these mafias in New York. There's like a Michigan Theater Mafia.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
Carnegie Mellon.
NYU.
And there's definitely a Yale Mafia. You know, there's a lot of people who went to Yale who go into theater, and you make connections. And my first day job, actually, I emailed my good friend from school. His mother is Anna Quinlan, who is a wonderful author, and among other things wrote the book, which was turned into a movie called One True Thing with Meryl Streep. And when I graduated, I emailed her and I said, hey, you know, I want to be an actor. I'm looking for a day job. Anybody you know that's looking for, you know, someone to help them out, I'd please pass it along. So then she told Meryl Streep, who told this woman at who she met at a fundraiser, you're looking for an assistant. I know someone. Of course, I've never met Meryl Streep, but she got me my first job working as a personal assistant for the producer, Ruth Hendel, I worked for up until last summer, right before I started Gentleman's Guide rehearsals. She's kind of like my mother. It's been like, you know, 7 years because I started working for her right out of college, and she's a wonderful person. She invested in Gentleman's Guide after I got cast. You know, she's kind of like my mom. I still go to, you know, their Rosh Hashanah dinners and things like that. So I got my first job from Meryl Streep. I just love saying that, even though I've never met the woman.
That's a great story. I love
really
that.
Great.
I love that. And also, I heard a rumor that you were, you worked as a line monitor at Spamalot.
Yeah, that was one of my first gigs, too. When I first graduated, I had about four jobs before I met Ruth, because she actually made it possible for me to have one job and work,
sure,
you know, a full day. Whereas before, you know, when you're working a line monitor, it's only 2 or 3 hours in the morning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I get up at 7 a.m., take the train to the theater. It was for Spamalot.
Yeah.
And wear my little hat, my shirt, and stand outside. And at the time, it was, I think it was $20.95. You could have two tickets per person. You had to have ID. And then during off hours, I would go downstairs and they'd let me play and sing on their piano.
That's great.
And it was a pretty, for me, it felt very magical, you know, because it was my first experience at Broadway. And I made really good friends with all the box office guys.
Box office guys and the ushers, those are the people who really run all of Broadway.
And the house manager.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to remind listeners that you can follow Lauren on her website, laurenwarsham.com. Also, if you want to get in touch with her on Twitter, you can go to, she's at Warsham Lauren. So, Lauren, why aren't you Lauren Warsham?
It was whatever they gave to me when I joined. I joined on a whim. On a whim. I do many things on a whim, I guess. I heard that Bill Nye, the science guy, was in the audience, the Gentleman's Guide, and I was like, oh gosh, how do we get him to come backstage? Because I'm a fan. So I joined Twitter at intermission, and I tweeted, Bill Nye, if this is you, like, if you're outside in the audience, please come backstage. And he did. I don't know if it's because of Twitter or not. I had to take a picture with him, and that was the first picture that I tweeted, too, with me and Bill Nye, the science guy.
So you didn't ask him if that's why he came back?
No, I didn't. I was verklempt. I'm, you know, it's like someone, it'd be like meeting Mr. Rogers, you know, like that's, you know, my childhood.
That is great.
You have some great stories there, Lauren.
I love that.
I'm glad.
Oh, I'm looking at the picture here. Bill Nye. Just met Bill Nye and pretty much fangirled out. Sorry for the bad photo, Mr. Science Guy. Oh, you guys are adorable.
I think I have my wig cap on and my hair is still in pin curls. One of the two. Because I literally ran.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. April 17th. There it is. I'll put that in the show notes so that folks can find that picture and then follow you on Twitter as well. So Lauren, thanks so much for getting up. I know Sunday mornings and early and everything like that is terrible for most folks in the business, but we really appreciate you taking time out to visit with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. And Michael, I'm sure will come back and give us the lowdown on the Philharmonic, and it sounds like such an amazing cast. So have a wonderful time with that.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So let's jump right into our reviews of the morning. Both of you got a chance to see It's Only a Play, the new Terrence McNally, or is it the new Terrence McNally show? So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, to address what James just said, this play was originally seen under, or well, the predecessor, the precursor of this play was originally seen in 1978, out of town. I forget which town it was.
Philadelphia.
Thank you. Under the title Broadway. And then it was done, at some point the title was changed to It's Only a Play. Was it changed for the off-Broadway production?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yes. It's an interesting course that the productions have taken. It was produced in 1982 at Manhattan Punchline, and then again off-Broadway in 1986 at Manhattan Theater Club. So it has apparently been extensively rewritten. And when you see it, you'll know why, because about 75% of it consists of jokes about theater celebrities and I guess some film and TV celebrities also. So they had to change a lot of the names because they wouldn't necessarily mean anything to people today, or they wouldn't mean as much. And that's what a lot of the humor is. So if you feel like you respond to that, a great deal of which is insult humor, then you might really enjoy this play. But for the first 10 minutes or so, I have to say, I thought this is probably going to be one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. It just seemed like it was really working, and Nathan Lane is so fantastic on stage. But then it immediately started to go off the rails, I thought, with where it seemed like everything just existed for the next insult humor joke. And the incredible thing about this play is that it's supposed to be an insider's view of theater, but at least half of the things that happen would never, ever happen in the theater in a million years. It's kind of like, it's very strange. It's sort of like Smash, of which I saw only one or two episodes and had to turn it off because at the same point I made with that show, why change things if it's not necessary? I mean, if you need to change facts and timelines and things like that for dramatic purposes or to make something funnier, fine. But if the things that actually happen in the theater, the way that they happen, are extremely interesting and funny and or dramatic, why change it to things that would never happen? I is that creativity? I just don't get it. I have like four pages of examples here of things that happened in this play that drove me absolutely crazy, and I will go through them quickly. It's as if no technology has changed in Terrence McNally's mind anyway over the past 25 or 30 years. All of the action takes place in an upstairs bedroom of the townhouse of a producer who is giving an opening night party for a play that she has produced called The Golden Egg. Now, first of all, no one I know in the theater can think of a single instance where an opening night party was held in a producer's townhouse. So that's A. Don't know why he didn't pick have it at Sardi's and then have the action take place in another room. Don't know what that's all about. Well, actually, I guess the original reason why that didn't happen is that a great deal of the action takes place, the dialogue takes place over phone calls that are received on the landline in the producer's bedroom. And this, incredibly enough, has not been changed, even though to have changed it to cell phone calls would have been incredibly easy to do. So I why he didn't change that is really beyond me. That's only one example. Let's see here. It's just one joke after another. So many of them are so mean-spirited, very bitchy, kind of stereotypically gay humor. There's a whole soapbox that McNally gets on that seemed it was kind of embarrassing to me because he really goes off against Brit theater, Brit playwrights, Brit directors. At one point, there's a line, somebody says something like, why don't we just move the Tony Awards to London and give them out over there? And I couldn't help feeling that that was his chip on his shoulder because he has maybe felt that he should have gotten some awards over the years that he didn't get because the Brits got them. And it really embarrassed me. There's a cheap joke about Liza Minnelli. Here's an example of, I'm not going to be dishonest here. There are quite a few jokes that if you take them in themselves are hilarious. But then there are all the others. And what happens is the audience is so primed to laugh that it's a really interesting phenomenon. They will laugh at something that's not remotely funny because they're so primed to laugh by the previous three lines or whatever. So at one point somebody says, somebody says that they saw someone earlier at the show that evening in the audience and said, and she said, you look like Hillary Clinton. And she said, I hope so. I am Hillary Clinton. Is that funny? But people laughed at it. It was really weird. Let's see. Matthew Broderick plays the author of this play, The Golden Egg. And Nathan Lane plays a actor who has become started out as a stage actor, has become a TV star, and was supposed to have starred in this play, but then couldn't do it because of his commitment to his series. And so we understand that there had been a rift between the two of them for this reason. And you know what's interesting? I'm the only person I know who commented on this. Maybe Peter noticed too. I thought that was I assume that's something that must have been added since the original. And I thought that was sort of a comment on what happened between McNally and Nathan Lane when they went to make the film of Love, Valor, Compassion. Does anyone remember that?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, there was a lot of, and it was in the press about that.
Yes,
there were very, very hard feelings because, and I can't even remember the reason now, but Nathan Lane could not do the film of Love, Valor, Compassion, and it wound up being Jason Alexander. And apparently there was a rift between the two of them that lasted, a couple of years or so. And then obviously they made up because they...
Mm-hmm. Here he is, right. Yeah.
But I thought that that was interesting that that was added to it. And actually that was one of the more interesting things I found about the play. There's a theater critic played by F. Murray Abraham who is at the opening night party, which... First of all, what? Okay. Secondly, not only is he there, he everyone finds their way into the bedroom for some reason. It's like, who is in the party downstairs? They're all in the bedroom, all getting calls on the landline in the bedroom. And the critic is going after the people, you know, the other people at the party, including his host, and including the actor, and including the playwright. He's going after everyone right there at the party, which is like a little bit requires a little bit more suspension of disbelief than I could ever muster in my lifetime. We have a scene where the reviews finally come in. Do they read the reviews online like everyone else in the world does now? No, the review is read to Nathan Lane over the phone by the press agent, and he then repeats the entire review as it's being read to him. I just don't get it. The Schuberts call that night, immediately after the reviews come in, demanding to know if the producer was going to close the show or not. Let's see. Nathan Lane says if his TV gets word that his TV show has been canceled, he says we never had a chance, even though we're then told it ran for 8 years. The reviews that we hear read, including the purported Ben Brantley review of The Golden Egg, are things that no professional critic would ever write in any universe. One of the TV reviews says, this show stinks. This show stinks. Does he hate critics that much? Is that what he's doing? I don't get it. Matthew Broderick is giving the same performance he's given for the past 20 years, that kind of robotic Jewish guy who walks like he's got a pole up his butt and talks. Well, I think that that's not what I'm going to be here for.
It's a pretty good imitation, Michael.
But wait a minute. That's not true.
I think we have replacement.
Yeah, yeah.
Matthew's
out. Yeah. I don't want it. The C word is used three times just to shock the audience and make them think that somebody is writing a play because they're affecting them. Except one time you hear it as the K word, which I won't I won't explain that because it's just ridiculous motivation for all of them to be in the bedroom. And Nathan Lane at one point says, who do you have to fuck to get some food around here? Even though he's not set foot downstairs since we've seen him. So I don't know if he expected like somebody to bring up a tray to the bedroom or what that was supposed to be.
Maybe he was in a bad production of West Side Story.
It is, as someone else said to me, it's so ironic because the whole point of it is that it's supposed to be so insider humor. But it seems like it's written by someone who never even saw a play, let alone has written dozens and has been at God knows how many opening night parties. I can't understand it, especially since, as I said, it would have been quite easy to rewrite things to be much more plausible without making them any less and probably more interesting. Don't get it.
So before I let Peter jump in here, have either one of you had a chance to read Joe Domenowitz's article this morning in the Daily News? He wrote this piece that said, unlike real life, Broadway is free of cell phones, tweets, and texts. And it hits a few of the things that Michael just talked about, and it's only a play about using landlines and not having technology, yet placing the show in 2014, but not having all these things available to us. I thought it was very interesting because he points out some of the same things that you're pointing out, Michael. It's only a play, but it also in The Country House. But it's an interesting article, and we'll have it. I'll put it in the show notes as well. But Peter, how did you feel about this? Is it a tale of two cities?
Well, for one thing, we have to mention that this is one of the most star-studded shows on Broadway.
Yes.
And that point was reiterated to me at the end, because how often does an Oscar winner, and I mean F. Murray Abraham, take his curtain call bow, and still four people have yet to take theirs? I mean, that doesn't happen very often. So I was a little disappointed that Matthew Broderick got the last bow. I don't know if they switch around, but at least at my performance, he got the last bow. And I would think that Nathan Lane would get it because he has more to do. And I don't think he ever leaves the stage. And
it was quite, at least when I was there, it was one of those kind of really uncomfortable things, because there was a noticeable lessening of the applause when Matthew came.
I agree with that as well. I decided to keep statistics on this show while I was watching it, because early on there were so many names being dropped, I thought, gee, I wonder if he's going to be able to give a name for every letter of the alphabet. So I kept track of that to see. And he does go from Julie Andrews to Catherine Zeta-Jones, but couldn't find one for UV or, of course, X. He does mention Queen Elizabeth. So there's a lot of name dropping in this play. But I also kept track on how many times the audience gave entrance applause, and 6 out of 7 got entrance applause. And then there were either applause that came from laughs or other moments 17 times. 18 times the theater goers went, ooh, you know, at his audacious pot shots at various has-beens like Faye
Dunaway. That many times, really?
Yeah.
I think there was only one when I went.
Uh-huh. I guess my audience was more scandalized than yours. And 3 times my program fell from my lap because I was laughing so hard. So this is a farce. I mean, I see it in that way. And when I think of it compared to Moss Hart's version of this play, which was called Light Up the Sky, which got done quite a bit in summer stock during the 50s, 60s, and even 70s, I think this is a far superior work than that, because I think it's far funnier. And yet, in the midst of all this comedy about a new play's bombing with terrible reviews, I find some humanity here. As McNally points out, that lives, reputation, money are all on the line. And he lets us even feel what these poor souls are feeling. Leo Bloom in the movie, the producer, I don't remember if he does it in the musical, says actors are people, you know, and and so are playwrights and producers, directors, and yes, even critics, you know. So and McNally, I'm sure, has eaten with all of them, you know, to deal with Zero Mostel's rebuttal on that. So, Michael, when Nathan Lane said, oh, we never had a chance for a series that ran 8 years, this to me was the typical actor's response to the fact that even though there's been success, there hasn't been enough of it, and he feels there should have been more of it, that sense of entitlement. So that's how I viewed that line. Of course, it's astonishingly long for a comedy. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes, if it's a millisecond. There are some times when, yes, as Michael says, he gets on his soapbox and does preach a little. And I understand that as well. But this, to me, is a right that a man has who has been around the theater so long. It's nice to see what's on his mind. It tells us a great deal about ourselves. Why do we have so much schadenfreude about a play's bombing? Because the second act begins essentially with the reading of Ben Brantley's review. Of course, Michael, there would never be a critic who would write anything like that. I mean, though I will admit that when I heard that Joey Buttafuoco was going to be in a play. You may recall this guy who had a big thing going with Amy Fisher, and I heard he was going to be in a play, and I was if indeed I went to see the show and he was no good, I did plan to start my review simply with the two words, "He stinks." Anyway, but but, you know, I mean, you know, that review that's read really tells us a lot about ourselves. Why are we so amused by the fact that somebody gets a bad review? And we've all done it. I mean, we've all cackled over it, these things. So I think it tells us a little bit about ourselves. So I guess it's because I've never enjoyed Light Up the Sky very much. Every time I go, I hope I'm going to like it more. I've seen it four times. And I think McNally has trumped Moss Hart's Ace in this regard. So I had a pretty good time, even when the action flagged a little. And while you're quite correct about the technology aspects of the play, I was being carried away so much by what was happening and the witty lines that were coming at me. I have to admit that it never even occurred to me that these things were problematic. And maybe it's because I've seen the play before, not during this pre-Broadway tryout with Geraldine Page and James Coco in the roles whom I assume are now played by Megan Mullally and Nathan Lane. I assume. I don't know that for a fact. Lenny Baker, a very gifted actor who died much too young of, I believe, throat cancer, was in it too. And he won a Tony for I Love My Wife back in 1977. And but I did see that Manhattan Punchline production, because once I heard it was being done, I couldn't wait to get there. So this to me was visiting an old friend. And it certainly does have a lot of insider jokes. And I will admit, the audience I was with, after all, was full of insiders. I don't know how this is going to play in the long run. But it's not going to have that long a run. But though I think it could, certainly this is the hottest ticket in town at the moment. I'm very glad I was there. I got a little exercise from picking up my program three times, bending over, you know, which is about as much as critics usually get for exercise. So so as a result, I think that those of our listeners who already have tickets may have a better time than you did, Michael. And those who don't have tickets, I think, may for a long time wish that they could have got them. So, again, I haven't even mentioned such people as Stalker Channing, who's very, very funny as an actress who is making a type of comeback. It's not the type of comeback that she'd really like to make. Megan Mullally's voice is not a stage voice to me. I didn't think it was up to the others. And F. Murray Abraham, yeah, I know what you mean, Michael. But I've been to some opening night parties. And by the way, I think there are many opening night parties that don't take place in restaurants. So I certainly know that there are small gatherings of people who get together on opening night in apartments and townhouses, et cetera, rather than go to restaurants. It's amazing to me how many don't take place at places like Sardi's. I think the Sardi's thing is somewhat of a thing of the past. So, I think you, what people should do is just go and enjoy it for all the wonderful assets that it has.
So I wanted to point out about it's only a play, that the grosses over the last 8 weeks have been amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, and usually, and something we don't really talk about is that in the beginning of the show, certainly through the preview period, the first week after opening, there's a ton of comps that happen because they invite press and they invite insiders and things like that. And usually those comps eat really heavily into grosses. So sure. Even though you might have a full theater, you don't have a gross that's up there. Now, It's Only a Play has not had a gross less than 100% so far. 112%, 104%, 110%. And the capacity has been over 100% as well, meaning that they've sold the entire theater plus standing room. So it looks as though that, you know, that these that people are eating it up. It got, I would say, mixed reviews. Would you agree?
Certainly.
Mixed reviews.
That might be a generous way of putting it, frankly.
And
they're going to need it because, as Peter alluded, it is a limited run unless they change their minds. But they'd have to, aside from everything else, they'd have to replace Nathan Lane, at least for a while, because he's scheduled to do The Iceman Cometh at BAM.
Yeah.
So, it's not an obvious thing to say, one would assume that the star salaries on this one are about as high as can be. So, it may not be a windfall, despite the incredible grosses. From their point of view, hopefully they will pay back. I don't know how much gravy there's going to be on top of that, but I really have no clue.
So it's excuse me. So that's so it seems as though that they seem to have a formula here. Insofar as critics writing horrendous reviews, I think back to Miss Saigon, where we had the one-liners of "Oh, the horror" as an entire review in the New Yorker.
Oh, really?
Yes. Other things, "A Miss in Saigon." Or what was one of the other ones? But they were pretty harsh reviews, and I think that people do see that.
In this he says things like this man should never write a play again, and in fact he should never. There's a line like something like he should never have been born, so he wouldn't have been able to write this play. It's a little much.
Well, I think we have to use some standards like we would with Boeing or plays like that. It's a farce. Under those circumstances, things happen that we don't really feel need to be centered in such reality. I guess there are slamming doors in this play, but not in the conventional way of a farce, I'll grant you. And there's very little said about sexuality, but which of course is a mainstay of farce. But still, you know, I guess it was a case where I was asked to give my forbearance, and I did give it, and I had no problem giving it. So, and Michael, you're certainly well within your rights not to give it. I mean,
I understand your point, especially. I mean, obviously, it's not supposed to be. Well, I wouldn't say it's intended as a realistic piece, you know. So you're right, and whether or not farce is the actual term, I certainly understand what you're meaning. But I guess I still don't understand why the need to change to things that wouldn't happen when the things that would happen are just as interesting or funny. And to cite only that one thing, why couldn't there be a laptop there? Of course there would be. And why couldn't Nathan Lane have read from the laptop the review rather than holding a receiver of a landline to his ear and repeating everything that the press agent is telling him? Would that have made it less funny? Or is it just laziness on the part of the not rewriting it? It would have needed minimal rewriting. He's just reading from a laptop instead of holding a receiver to his ear. I just not get it.
That, to quote Peter Stone, well, there you have me, Abby. You know, I mean, I can't disagree with you. I can't. You know, I can only say it didn't occur to me. And I'm not proud of the fact that it didn't occur to me.
I understand that you're giving yourself over to it. But I don't see, again, the point of making someone get over that hurdle when they didn't, then it didn't have to be there in the first place. And also, again, it's supposed to be, if someone had told me that this was written by someone who had never written a play and never been to an opening night party, that would have made more sense to me. Because it's ironic that it's for something that's supposed to be so insidery that so many things would never, ever, ever happen.
Yeah, I mean, McNally has written a first-rate farce, I feel, in The Ritz.
Ritz.
Which I adore. And and there are slamming doors there, and it's a much more conventional one. I guess the idea of it being set in such an ornate bedroom is one that doesn't seem to lend itself to that type of thing. But But again, yes, I went with it, and I was delighted to see it again, and I'm looking forward to reading it to see what names have been replaced and who's been thrown out, who's been added in. Nathan Lane's leaving to do Iceman Cometh, fine, but it must be really nice to be Nathan Lane these days, because not that it hasn't been in the past, but the play is set up in such a way that he, and Stalker Channing for that matter, get a type of entrance applause twice. And not only that, Nathan Lane is mentioned in the play, by Nathan Lane, in fact. I mean, the words Nathan and Lane are used, you know, and that's a terrific tribute, you know, that somebody is that famous and, shall we say, powerful to have that happen. And
also Harvey Fierstein, but we won't give that one away.
But Harvey ain't in the play, you know. I mean, his Nathan Lane right. Really there, you know. So that's a real nice thing for an actor to have to experience. Very few have that as much as you know. As I say, two bursts of entrance applause and a reference to yourself. Wow, you've arrived. I mean, not that we had any doubts that Nathan Lane had arrived, but still,
right.
This is yet another indication of where he fits in the star's firmament.
Hmm. All right, let's move forward into a new show that Peter's, I guess it's a series of shows called Inner Voices down at CBG Theater on 36th Street. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, God bless Paulette Haupt, who is a marvelous producer, and she has worked so hard to advance the musical theater. And what she does is she gets people and links them together. So in this case, she got Charlene Woodard, whom most of us know as an original cast member of Ain't Misbehavin', and Kirsten Childs, a very talented writer who's bubbly show of years ago was a terrific off-Broadway experience. The bubbly boy sheds his chameleon skin, a terrific show that I was convinced was going to Broadway in 14 seconds and just didn't happen. But
I think it was the bubbly black girl sheds her chameleon skin.
Thank you. So a terrific piece. And here they are writing a musical, a small musical called Grace, small in the sense that it doesn't last longer than perhaps 40 minutes and is part of a double bill, and small because it's one person. And that's what Inner Voices does. I'm inferring that it's one person shows. I do believe that Andrea Frierson, who many of us may remember from the original cast of Once on This Island, is giving one of the great performances of the season, an amazing turn as Grace Monroe, a novelist who finds that she has a terrible affliction and she's going to have to deal with it. The music is very New World. This is not conventional musical theater. It will never be confused with Jerry Herman, nor will the other show, which is called The Other Room, in which Phoebe Stroll, a very fine performance, is doing a show that Mark Campbell, who we know from Urinetown, in Town, and Marissa Michelson, and again, Paulette Haupt, God bless her, put these two people together. And obviously it worked out because this one turned out well, too. And it's so nice to have this theatrical matchmaker doing such wonderful work in making people come together and writing such good stuff. This is about an artist who has a friend, a female artist who has a male friend who is dying and wants it to end sooner rather than later. And she's in on what he's going to do. And it really wonderfully shows the difficulties of being a friend in that position. Campbell has done an excellent job of showing the fact that, yes, you feel bad for your friend. If this is what he wants, this is what he should have. But on the other hand, should I enable this? You know, there are issues about euthanasia inherent in all this. And how you feel about that issue may be changed as a result of what you see in the other room. So I don't know if you've ever been to 312 West 36th Street, where there are three or four, maybe five little tiny theaters. This is at the biggest one, ironically enough, though I don't think it has more than 100 seats. But it was really something to see Andrea Frierson tear into this Grace show and make us feel so bad for this woman, and while delivering ambitious music, as does Phoebe Stroll. The music that Marissa Michelson wrote for The Other Room is very ambitious as well. So it is not conventional show music by any stretch of any imagination, and don't go expecting that. But if you want to hear hauntingly beautiful music, then this is the place to go through November 1st.
So, Peter, just a few steps away, you got a chance to see It Has to Be You with the Abington Theater Company. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, at the opening of Big last week, Stuart Ross, the wonderful smart man who made Forever Plaid and conceived it and wound up seeing it produced in virtually every town that's ever existed in this country, came up to me and said, look, I've directed this play and I really believe in it, so I think you should go. So I went. It Has to Be You, the name of it, and it's by Catherine Butterfield, who also appears in it as well. And I had a wonderful time. It's a play about two grown children, a man and a woman, brother and sister, who are driving because they really feel the time has come. They've got to put Mum in a senior citizen facility. It just has to happen. I mean, she's been deteriorating for a while, and you know, it's just one of those things. You know, what are you going to do? Both of them have problems in their own lives. The sister has been going with a man for 10 years. However, he would never leave his wife, and finally that's over. And the brother is having financial problems. He has a tuxedo store, and it's not doing well because even today, proms, they're not dressing up in tuxedos anymore. And his wife is getting fed up that they don't have any money, and he's afraid she's going to leave him. So everybody's got problems here, except when they arrive, they find out the mother does not have a problem. Even though she's 75 years old, she has a boyfriend who's in his 40s. And she has really come alive. You know, while she had been, you know, very old and infirm, suddenly she is full of life because she's got this young boyfriend. And they are scandalized. They do not want her with this man. They just find that it's just unseemly, disgusting. And to be frank, they're also worried that this man's a fortune hunter, that he's going to show up on the scene. He's going to take away the house when she dies, which, you know, there's a good chance that she's going to die before anybody else. Statistics would indicate that. And they're going to lose the house. So it's not just a case that they're a little put off by the fact that the mother is dating a much younger man who's essentially their age, by the way. But, you know, the financial aspect, which is certainly not unknown to people who have aging relatives. This is in the back of minds of people such as this. There's also a third brother. Who is clearly the mother's favorite. He's a set decorator in Hollywood, and he's the most successful of the three. And they say to him, do something to break this up. In fact, he does. And that's an interesting turn of events. And I'm going to have to bring up something that may give away too much of the plot, but one of the most impressive things that happened in this experience that I had yesterday was the fact that I have to admit, the audience in this play, for this play, I would say the average age was probably the mother's age, 75. Most everybody was quite elderly. All right, fine. I am not putting down old theater goers because they pay for their tickets too. It's always amazing to me when people say, we've got to get the young people in the theater. Do they pay more than the older people? Not usually. So, I mean, you should be glad when you have any type of audience. Thank God they're there. But here's my point. Somebody makes a type of, let's say, gay slur. It's not a severe one. It's one that shows a lack of understanding about gays, that I'm going to obfuscate it, and let's say it's the type of thing where they say it's learned behavior as opposed to you were born that way, that type of thing. And it was really something to hear the audience of 70 and 80-year-olds mock the assumption that I imagine they grew up hearing and believing. But even the 70 and 80-year-olds have changed their view, at least in this audience, and I think it's more widespread than we think. And it was so great to see an audience of that age not be on the side that they had probably been taught to be on since they were kids, you know, that gay is a terrible thing, even that I'm sure many of them were taught. And they have advanced to the point where they realize that this is not true. Again, I wish I could be more specific, but I don't want to give away too much. But it was such a pleasure to hear this audience. And it reminded me once again, homophobes out there, you're losing. You're going to lose. It's over. Stop this fight. You cannot possibly win this. You're not going to get what you want. When an audience of this scope is one that isn't on your side, whoa, it's over. Case closed, and thank God.
And when even the Pope
is saying
look at that. Really encouraging, that I never thought would happen in my life.
Well, the wonderful thing about that is, you know, this has really checkmated so many people, because anybody who says, well, the Pope is wrong, excuse me, the Pope's infallible. He's going to excommunicate you. You know, I mean, you can't be a Catholic anymore. You can't. That's heresy. He's infallible.
It's one or the other, guys. You can't have both.
You can't. So as a result, that was one of the most pleasurable. But it's a very well-written play. It comes to a very sharp and unexpected conclusion. And I really respected it very, very much. Very well done, too. So Stuart Ross directed it very nicely. And I hope it goes on. It deserves a wider forum. I can see this off-Broadway in a commercial house in New World Stages, and it would bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. So I am rooting for It Has to Be You.
Yeah. It's Abington Theater Company. On 312 West 36, on the sixth floor, where Peter's going up the elevator there from the third floor to the sixth floor for the previous show. I'll have information on it in the show notes as well. But it does, I got a press release about it, Michael. You didn't get a press release? As we talk about, it has been crazy fall. A wonderful fall.
Sure.
All right. So anything coming up this week that you should tell us about?
In fact, I mentioned last week I was due to see a stage version of Deliverance. And I missed it just because of my own scheduling screw up. But I've rescheduled for later this week. So I really do plan to see it. And I look forward to telling you about it, because it's done by a company that I whose work I really admire. So hopefully I will get to that. In addition to, let's see, this week coming on the town, the Belle of Amherst, a play called The Brightness of Heaven down at the Cherry Lane Studio, Can Can at Paper Mill, because I missed that. It's really a busy fall.
I'm going up to Goodspeed to see Holiday Inn.
Oh, you are? Yeah, oh, yeah, that's going to be great.
It may. Who knows? You know, so, but we'll see. But yes, I'm doing that as well. So yeah, there is a lot going on.
So now, are these two Irving Berlin Christmas stage musicals going to duke it out for the next few years?
We'll have to wait and see. There's never a dearth of this type of thing. How long will it be before there's yet another Gershwin musical cramming in Gershwin songs into some sort of new book or some rework book? And how long will it take for a critic to say, who could ask for anything more? You know? That's what always happens to those shows.
Oh, and on that note, briefly, I didn't know about this until about an hour before, and I was out, so I missed the first part of it. I'm sure it was publicized, but I didn't see it. There was a telecast, PBS telecast this week, and I'm sure they're repeating it. I think it was last night, actually, of Porgy and Bess, which of course now is called The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, which we won't get into that. But this was a San Francisco opera production, and it is basically the original version. I mean, you know, with cuts, because the complete thing is, you know, is 3.5 hours long, not including intermission. For anyone who wants to see and hear what that plays like, I urge you to look at check your listings and see when it's repeated. I think actually someone said it's already out on DVD and maybe Blu-ray, because they worked the contracts that way. It's San Francisco opera production directed by Francesca Zambello, and so I think it's great that that's out there and also commercially available. There was a New York City Opera production that was telecast in the 90s that I fortunately made a VHS copy of, but I know that's, you can't buy it, you know, at least not over the counter. I mean,
in the dark internet,
we know what you mean.
Theater, yeah. Things for sale.
No, I think it's great. And the only other version of it that's commercially available that's more or less traditional to the original is that one, the production from, was it Glyndebourne?
What about the Houston one? Didn't Houston get recorded?
No, if only, Peter.
Uh-huh.
If only. Okay. I don't think so. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that Trevor Nunn one is has its moments, except that they lip sync to the recording. And so that almost destroys the whole
Sure, thing. Sure.
But this one, yeah, check this out if you find it. It's really worth it.
All right, I guess that wraps it up for this week. I want to remind the listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us through many different applications. One of them is called Stitcher, which is an app for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to your device. Broadway World Radio also plays this Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m. and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
My darling, of course I accept your proposal.
Now we should kiss.
That would be bliss.
Darling, but first I'll say this. I've decided to marry you.
Phoebe.
I've decided to marry you.
Phoebe.
Then the trumpet I hold.
She is born with fall and set me free. And again there's Sabella. Yes, I've decided to marry you. Phoebe, look what you've done to me. For your gracious bestowment. Yes, Wadsworth, I told you, I'll be just a moment.
Now, Monty, dear, I think I now should go.
Oh.
But I still want to marry you.
Even so.
I've decided to marry you.
Just go.
How I'm longing to marry you.
Yes, I'm delighted to marry you, marry you, marry you. Yes, she must go.